Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Those of you who are regulars with our program know very well one of our other regulars. She is Diana West, the extraordinary author of two really important books, The Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. And we have the privilege of having a full hour of her time to walk through with her some of the insights of these two books, one very much about sort of the cultural, civilizational crisis we're experiencing as a result of the infantilization of our population, and the second about subversion and what has happened to us in the past and insights we can glean as to what's going on at the moment. She is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist. She is also a superb blogger at DianaWest.net. You can also catch her writings from time to time in places like the Daily Caller. But we're always especially appreciative when she is appearing here on Secure Freedom Radio. Diana, welcome back. So good to have you.
Wonderful to be with you, Frank.
Well, thank you especially for giving us time to have a deeper dive on some of the work that you do, and is ordinarily the case when we're grabbing you on the fly with three other guests in the program. So I want to pick up, though, on something that we didn't have time to really do justice on the last time you were visiting, namely insights from your book, Death of the Grown-Up, with respect to what we've been experiencing of late, specifically in the context of the nomination and confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to be a justice of the Supreme Court, and all that has flowed from it in terms of really the bad behavior. You know, it feels as though it's kind of a choice now between civilization on the one hand and the barbarians at or inside the gate. Talk us through this.
Yes. Yes. Well, the death of the grown-up, of course, is a metaphor that I chose in 2007 when the book came out. I'd been thinking about this really since 9/11 or even before 9/11. But 9/11 drove the death of the grown-up metaphor forward in my mind because I had been working as an editorial writer and columnist at the Washington Times at the time of 9/11, and along with most Americans had to learn about Islam at that moment, September 11th, 2001, and thereby began my own interaction with it as a subject, as an editorial subject, as a pressing matter to learn about and understand how it had thrust itself into our political and emotional and relational lives at that time. And I found such reluctance to discuss Islam in anything like a grown-up fashion that this even though it was a metaphor, it began to really take hold with me in terms of looking around the culture more generally and seeing how the worship of youth, how the domination of the popular culture, certainly by youth, by the money of young people and the direction to cater to that young marketplace after World War II, had changed us and had taken us to this place where across society we no longer saw stand-up adult behavior, whether it was in the classroom or in the political world or in, of course, the cultural realm, the popular culture and elsewhere. And this became, if anything, more vivid to explain, at least to introduce the discussion of why we couldn't face facts about Islam, why we couldn't talk about jihad and dhimmitude and the expansionist era of jihad that we found ourselves in. And so this was sort of my way to introduce a cultural narrative that sort of gave us a long view on how we become who we were at this moment, and a way to try to sort of jolt people into taking a more productive and measured, studied, sober look at having a political argument, having a political debate. And really in the decades since the book came out, I would say that things have only gotten worse. So I don't know that I contributed much.
You were explaining what was going down, that's for sure. And Diana, I think you mentioned this term cultural Marxism. It's such an important element of what has happened here, it seems to me. Could you discuss what that is and how it has operated specifically inside the academy to bring us to this present pass?
Yes, of course. Well, cultural Marxism is the way we understand the incursion of Marxist or Marxian ideas into the culture. And this is a very important term to understand because it's not an overtly political kind of movement. It's really the boring from within of the culture, of religious institutions, educational institutions. And people generally take it back to the introduction of an Italian communist named Gramsci and his ideas, which were to move the movement into cultural realms, since they couldn't just knock off the governments as Lenin had hoped following the revolution in 1917-1918. They had a failure politically, and there was this effort to take the long march through the institutions into the culture. I would argue, however, that cultural Marxism is something that really goes back to Marx himself, and certainly to the early socialists and Fabians that we see before the Russian Revolution working their way, sort of creeping socialism through a society in England known as the Fabians, which really come to critical mass really by the turn of the 20th century. They were very influential. They were all well-dressed, all well-mannered, came right out of the British wealthy classes, and worked symbiotically with the revolutionaries, with the Bolsheviks. They were supportive of them and so on at that time, and already were introducing Marxism into the educational system as well as the political system and religious institutions. So it's a very long process and very widespread. Mm-hmm. It's a long march and has great breadth and depth.
And it continues, needless to say. And I think it's your point, if I understand you correctly, that where Lenin had failed, the Gramscians, the cultural Marxists have succeeded not only in dominating the academy and the political world, but also to a very considerable degree the culture of our society as well, and contributed to this infantilization, shall we say, or at least this domination of the population. Diana, we have to pause for just a moment. I'm very much anxious to talk with you about how all this plays into the sort of Marxist concept of, or Hegel's concept, you might say, of the state as all-powerful. So much more to talk about. We have a full hour. I couldn't be more pleased with Diana West. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Joining us is Diana West. Virtually, she is in the house, as they say, but she is always on our minds because of her extraordinary clarity about so many of the issues that most of us don't quite, well, in many cases, notice, let alone comprehend. And so it's always a treat to have a chance to talk with her, and most especially to talk with her at length, which we have the chance to do today. And Diana, we were talking a bit about the efforts to subvert us from within, and it's a topic on which you have written so brilliantly, particularly in your book, American Betrayal. But before we get into all of that, I just wanted to tease out with you something that I spoke of with a previous guest, a friend of ours, Elizabeth Sabadish Wolf of Austria. And she made the point that in Europe, in the absence of our constitution and its protections, the state grants certain privileges or rights to the individual, or withholds them, or more to the point, takes them away at will. Whereas we believe, and it's enshrined in our Constitution, that we have unalienable rights from God, not from the state, and they can't be taken away from us with impunity. How does that distinction play into what these cultural Marxists, the Gramscians and so on, are trying to accomplish in the way of, well, to quote Barack Obama, fundamentally transforming America?
Yes. Well, remember, we used to talk about atheistic communism. I mean, this is the crux of the difference here, and it plays out into everyone's lives, regardless of their own religious beliefs. Our system does grant or doesn't grant us. Our system enshrines the unalienable rights that come to us from God, and the statists, the collectivists, the anti-constitutionalists end up with a system whereby there is an elite that controls you. And it's a collective. It can be very small. It's very powerful. And it is absolutely antithetical to the existence of individual liberty that is enshrined under due process, under rule of law, with what they sometimes call procedural justice as opposed to distributive justice, which, of course, is socialism. So this is a very important distinction to be made and to understand what is at risk of being lost as we move, as so much of our culture moves in this socialistic direction.
And so this isn't happening by accident. This isn't the product of some natural evolution. This is being accomplished by people who are very deliberately and purposefully and systematically and patiently working to subvert our form of government and the principles and values and freedoms that it's based upon. So talk a little bit about the boring from within phenomenon and how they've practiced it, particularly earlier in the last century, in the run-up to World War II, and the insights that you've taken from that for our own time.
Yes, well, I think it's very important to sort of roll the clock back to a point where most Americans understood that communism was a revolutionary movement to destroy our constitutional form of government. And this would be really exemplified in the refusal of four presidents to recognize the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik regime that took place, that took power in Moscow from 1918 forward. And 1917 and then in 1918. And these four presidents understood that you could not normalize relations with a revolutionary entity that was openly dedicated to destroying you. I mean, this was just a very simple but concrete, morally clear line to take. And there were six secretaries of state who also supported this in that same period until we get up to Franklin Roosevelt, who in 1933 made this very fateful decision to normalize relations with this abnormal entity. And the basis of this was a set of promises coming from Moscow, coming from, this would have been Stalin at the time in charge, coming out of Stalin, promising not to try to overthrow our government. This was essentially the basis of the agreement. And there were a series of other points, but there were also many iterations of this main idea that they would cease and desist trying to overthrow us. Well, the catch was is that this effort was already underway, and it continued from the moment the paper was signed. There was no abatement, and in fact, it increased. And what that agreement between the United States and the USSR meant was that there was now a new acceptance of the Soviet Union, of Bolshevism, and even communism that allowed to go the entry of hundreds of communists, pro-communists, fellow travelers, and indeed Soviet agents into the Roosevelt administration, which at that point was burgeoning. You know, we were getting this explosion of bureaucracy. Really, the nascent deep state was being set up in the 1930s. And this is who the New Deal, and this is who populated it. And of course, that bureaucracy has only grown and has only replicated itself as we go forward, decade by decade, to our own time.
Yeah, this is such an important point. Prior to this onslaught, if I can call it that, the bureaucracies were, I think it's fair to say, relatively small, but also relatively conservative, notably the State Department, I think your research has shown, is a place in the years leading up to FDR, in which the Foreign Service officers and the other personnel of the Department of State were, you know, what I guess we would call conservative Republicans, more or less at that time, but not afterwards. That's for sure. And I think it's true of most of the other government bureaucracies, even the Defense Department. You know, I remember having served under President Reagan in a couple of fairly senior positions, being impressed that unlike the State Department and some of the other agencies with which I interacted, the civil servants in the Defense Department were still fairly conservative and fairly robust, especially when it came to the Soviet Union. But I don't think that's true so much anymore, alas. And again, this is a function of a process that has continued to the present day. And Diana West, as you've done your research into the efforts to expose what was taking place in the, well, World War II period, I guess, and post-war period especially, to identify and root out these communists and agents of Moscow and socialists and so on, there was a degree of co-option of the government, of senior levels, that I think it's important for us to tease out as well, if you can. How did that operate and why?
Well, this is, I think, the crux of it in terms of the application to our own time. This is why this is not ancient history. This is why this is informs current events. What you had at the end of World War II, as Republicans began to take power back in Washington, in the Congress, for sure, right away, was essentially the original swamp, the original deep state that completely perplexed and confounded all those who looked at it, because it was a deep state undercover, completely covert. You had these information spills originally brought out by defectors. We would have to call Chambers, Elizabeth Bentley, Louis Budenz, defectors from the communist movement, from indeed the Soviet intelligence world, who told us what was going on and thereby allowed the investigators, the congressional investigators from Republican Party, Democrat Party, from the House, from the Senate, to begin to try to figure out how our government had become co-opted and subverted, how our policymaking had been essentially hijacked. And this becomes the flashpoint of what we look back on as the Cold War, and yet we tend not to see it that way. We tend to look at the Cold War that began, we say, after World War II, as being something that took place somewhere else, you know, in Europe, in the Far East, and so on. Not so. This was being fought right here in Washington, D.C., and the closer the investigators got to the heart of the matter, to the communist networks inside the government, the worse it became for those anti-communists. And this becomes a flashpoint. And indeed, I would say, and I don't think it's controversial at all to say, that the anti-communists ultimately lost, because we lost our capacity to uncover our enemies, not just foreign, but domestic. And the whole notion of subversion became a dirty word, the word we use not Red Baiter anymore, but McCarthyism. And this became a greater sin than trying to commit treason. In other words, rooting out treason became the crime. And this is really why it is so difficult today, as we confront the anti-Trump conspiracy, why it is so hard for people to try to even sense whether there is an ideological component, which I do believe there is and can be demonstrated. So this is why understanding this history becomes a way of understanding our current crisis.
This is such an important insight. And again, I think partly because, as you say, of the way this issue of rooting out subversion has now been essentially proscribed. I believe our counterintelligence services, to say nothing of our public awareness of and opposition to these sorts of threats, has been fatally weakened, leaving us even more vulnerable to such sorts of onslaughts as we've seen in the past and you've documented so well, and as we are seeing at the moment. In fact, when we come back, Dinah West, I want to talk to you about some of the investigative work you've done about John Brennan, for example, and what you call the red thread. That and much more with our guest, Dinah West, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Blogger par excellence, Dinah West, longtime syndicated columnist, best-selling author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, is with us, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. If you've missed the first two segments, I hope you'll go back and listen to them on your podcast. They are indispensable in terms of understanding what we're going to get into now, which is, what is happening in our own time? Are there still subversives who have burrowed into our institutions, notably our governing institutions, for the purpose of subverting our government, our constitution, our republic? And if so, who are they? And how successful are they being? Dinah West, again, thank you again for staying and sharing so much really important insight and information with us. You've done a series of articles, columns, if you will, at your website, I believe, and perhaps elsewhere, on this question that you call the red thread. Talk about what you mean by that and the evidence that you've compiled that it exists and is very much operating at the moment.
Yes, well, the red thread is the way I think of my own thought experiment, which is to try to follow a thread of red, of socialism, of communism, of Marxism, Alinskyism, progressivism, the collectivist mindset that I do believe is...
The Borg, I think it's been called.
Yes, the anti-Trump conspiracy. And I began with Nellie Orr because she was really the easiest in that she has a she was an academic, and there are writings of hers that are there to analyze, and discovered literally an apologist for Stalin. This is something I've you know, walked through. It's truly an astonishing shock to find such a person in our time, but they are there. And she is one of them. And of course, she worked for Fusion GPS and on the dossier, and her husband is the prominent Department of Justice official who's also involved in all of these doings at the moment.
That would be Bruce Orr, of course.
Bruce Orr. And indeed, there are quite a few threads here. Now, some of them out themselves, and we can talk about John Brennan, of course, who himself in September of 2016 brought up in a panel on diversity in the intelligence world, he brought out the fact that he was so diverse that he had voted for the Communist Party boss Gus Hall in 1976. And even knowing that, the CIA hired him anyway. So this becomes this was tremendously shocking to kind of the old cold warriors out there, fewer and farther between as they may be.
I am one of them, proud to say.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It put a lot of people's hair on fire. But when you actually look more closely at Brennan's biography, including, for example, his master's thesis, you find that he actually was quite enamored with the socialism of Nasser, the Egyptian dictator of yore, and truly waxed rhapsodic about land expropriation. I mean, this is who John Brennan was, and I would say is. I mean, this is somebody who's very committed to the collectivist concept of justice. He talks about distributive justice. I mean, these are words that are fine in the faculty lounge, given that we've sort of ceded the campus to the Marxists. But when you think about a CIA director having these beliefs, it shows you how far out of whack our institutions have become. I mean, we think of the CIA as fighting the good fight, and yet we find out that Brennan and Leon Panetta before him were people who were very closely associated with this movement.
Yeah. You know, you say it's fine to have it in the academy. I think it's not fine there, as I know you believe too, although having it as part of a discourse, that's one thing. But to have, as you say, people who are, it seems, really imbued with this anti-constitutional mindset and ideological fervor is something altogether different when, especially they're in senior government positions like the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And Diana, as you've explored what Brennan's role was in all of this and the others, the Nellie Oars and so on, have you found that there's a real determination on their part to take down candidate Trump, and ultimately when he won the presidency, his administration, in the service of this statist enterprise and out of a concern that he would, in fact, roll it back, all the progress that had been made?
I think that is the right way to look at this. And when you do see the ideological affinity for socialistic ideas among so many of these anti-Trump conspirators, and you put that, you juxtapose that with what I believe Donald Trump is literally our most anti-communist president ever, and that would even include St. Ronald Reagan, given that Trump's position in history, Trump's time in history, and what he comes out of himself is to, his raison d'etre is to rebuild the nation state. And the nation state is the bulwark against communism. It is the basis from which you can resist communism. It's the only basis. And I would say going back to the Reagan years, we are looking at, Reagan was a very big free trader, for example. This is something that the communists are able to infiltrate and subvert.
Well, the whole globalist enterprise.
Absolutely. And even in terms of the internationalist role that Reagan was in at that time, that too is something that can be subverted and turned. And I think we've seen that over the decades in terms of where America has been taken and gone and kind of lost itself. So if you have in Trump this real counter-revolutionary figure coming out of the blue, because he shouldn't have been there, he shouldn't have run, he shouldn't have won.
He shouldn't have been an anti-communist, for that matter. You know, he was you know, a businessman.
Yes, all of those things are true, but when you go back to his own formative influences, which would include Norman Vincent Peale, who was his pastor and a very prominent anti-communist, anti-New Dealer all through much of the 20th century, you really start to see an ideological divide open up and reveal itself to be communism versus anti-communism. And when you pair that against a James Comey, for example, who to this day holds as his most important mentor or intellectual influence, because he didn't know him personally, Reinhold Niebuhr, this becomes even more starkly an ideological divide. Reinhold Niebuhr and Norman Vincent Peale were on opposite sides of the communism, anti-communism debate back in the 20th century. And when you see a Norman Vincent Peale influenced Trump pitted against a Niebuhr versus influenced Comey, again, you are seeing the old battle lines take shape. And this is not an accident that a Comey, a Brennan, a Nellie Oar, a Christopher Steele, who coming from England, discussed in the press over there as having been a confirmed socialist at Cambridge, as having had, quote, CND credentials, CND having been the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, which was a very Marxist-infiltrated organization in the 1980s. I mean, MI5, I think, considered it Soviet influenced.
No question. I did too.
And you did too. When you start seeing all these people together co-opting, subverting, corrupting the electoral process, and then going on to try to undermine and destroy the presidency that Donald Trump won, you do have to start understanding this in ideological terms, which does make it much simpler. And I think it's something that people are, again, very afraid of doing, referring back to all the history we were talking about earlier, where looking to subversion, looking to ideology has become a thought crime. But I think it's to understand it, we absolutely have to just say that's rubbish and that's juvenile and try to be adult about it and actually get to a point where we can start looking at this in terms of ideology and saving the American way from the collectivist.
Yeah. But this, of course, Diana, is precisely why the left is so assiduously trying to suppress such thought experiments or such introspection or such investigations. This is designed, this practice of making these things, as you say, thought crimes, or for that matter, hate crimes, is to ensure that no one can become clued up about what these folks are trying to do and what their ultimate end state is. And say just a word about what the end state of this Marxist enterprise is as you see it, and fully knowledgeable that we'll be told that, oh, well, this is all a conspiracy theory and, you know, you're McCarthyites for even bringing these topics to the fore. But as you see it, Dinah West, is there any question as to what these ideologues have in mind?
Well, I don't. I think that it's junking the constitutional system that we have. It's junking the Constitution, and it's getting to a place where you have mighty overlords, and you are no longer a citizen; you are a subject.
And this gets you to the living Constitution idea, and having Supreme Court justices who are constantly, and other judges for that matter, interpreting it afresh, without any regard for precedent, let alone the plain meaning of the text.
Absolutely.
It's stunning. We have to pause for one more moment, and I just wanted to make sure that we sorted that, because what is of particular concern to me, and I think to you too, Dinah West, is that it's not just the left that we're up against with this kind of agenda broadly defined. It's another faction that is also burrowing within and also seeking the destruction of our constitutional form of government, and that is incredibly making common cause with people who seem to be completely at odds with most of the things that the second party, the Islamist or Sharia supremacists, are about. And we'll explore that, the red-green axis, with the great Dinah West right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the fourth and final installment of our very, very important conversation with Dinah West, author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her great writings at places like The Daily Caller and most especially dinahwest.net. She is the author of a forthcoming monograph for the Center for Security Policy, I'm very pleased to say, on this subject of the red thread, which we have been pulling with her. But I did want to broaden a bit the lens, Dinah, now, and tie in the collaboration between the radical left in this country and its Marxist agenda for subverting us, and a similar agenda, at least in terms of the methodology, if not exactly the end state, being pursued by adherence to the idea that Sharia should dominate the world. And I'm always struck by this because it seems as though a group like the left that is made up of feminists and homosexuals and Jews and apostates and the like couldn't possibly get on with people who want to kill all of those folks, which, of course, is pretty much, you know, the orthodoxy of Sharia. So how has this come to pass, and how serious a problem is it that it is at work, apparently, in our country?
Yes, well, I think one thing they used to say in the 60s, and probably before that, was the issue is never the issue. And I always think of that when I look at how the various victim groups or interest groups, such as you were describing, seem to cave every time their own interest is really at stake in the juggernaut of something like Islamic expansionism. If we look at homosexuals are supposed to be defenestrated under Islamic law, you would think you would have this massive counter-jihad movement emerging from that faction of the left, but you don't. Or similarly, of course, women who have no standing compared to men in a courtroom, et cetera, in terms of absolute servitude perpetrated upon women.
It's full-on misogyny. Let's call it what it is.
Exactly, and worse. So you would think that these interest groups, these people who seem to be pushing for liberation and expansion of their own rights as their own identities, identity groups, would have this sense of fear and need to protect themselves against Islamization, and yet they do not. So we start to see the red-green axis take shape, which I think ultimately speaks to the revolutionary drive of so many of these interest groups that are almost in disguise as interest groups or only need to push their interest in certain contexts. And when it actually comes right down to it, they are essentially anti-constitutionalists, anti-traditionalists, and are perfectly happy to move in lockstep with Islam, with communism, with these essentially collectivist ideologies that they just agree with far more than they do with a Western civilization and the various institutions therein. So we are always up against that apparent contradiction. But I mean, going back to, I think the first time I really noticed it in real time was back in the Bill Clinton days when it seemed like no feminist would say anything against him. And I think that still holds for the most part. So it's again, you think someone's ox is being gored, but it's not, because they really at base are revolutionaries.
Yeah. Amen. And unfortunately, the enemy of their enemy turns out to be a concept that they're perfectly prepared, at least for the present purpose, to allow to operate to our great detriment. And they'll sort out their differences later. My money's on the Islamists, by the way, rather than the communists, but we'll see. Diana, one other piece of this that I just want to ask you about, because you've given a lot of thought to it. This inability to identify and talk about and raise an alarm as needed concerning this enemy within problem, again, social democrats on the one hand, communists, Alinskyites, the Sharia supremacists, all of the above, is now being described as political correctness. But at the end of the day, it comes down to, doesn't it, the requirement that no one go where McCarthy dared to go. And interestingly enough, it seems that some on the right, at least, are throwing in with that kind of campaign.
Yes, that is so true. And it absolutely is one of the most frustrating fallacies that the right continues to hold on to. And this goes from Donald Trump down. This goes across the media, from Tucker Carlson to Joseph DeGeneva, just wonderful, wonderful people, great, great minds across the right, the spectrum of the right. And yet Lindsey Graham, Hugh Hewitt, Mitch McConnell, I mean, the list is very long in terms of people who continually misuse, and I say this with respect to their other contributions, but show great ignorance about the reality, the history of what was going on in the early 1950s, the investigations of Senator McCarthy, and then the counter movement to destroy Senator McCarthy, which by perpetuating the canard of McCarthyism, these conservatives today are actually buying right into And it is self-defeating in the most tragic and epic terms.
It's kind of bizarre, isn't it, really, that Donald Trump is seeing more clearly than just about anybody the evidence of this subversion within, not least because much of it's aimed at him and his presidency and the agenda that he has set for the country, including this idea of rebuilding, you know, our sovereignty and the nation state here in the United States. And yet what you're saying is because he describes some of what's going on as McCarthyist, he is giving fresh credibility to the idea that is now, you know, desiderata about Joe McCarthy, namely that he was a red baiter, that he was wrong, that he had no decency and all of that, when in fact he was right, and that he was doing an extraordinarily important service to the country and was not simply pilloried for it, but actually destroyed politically and ultimately physically.
Yes. And I found, I think, a very interesting way to, I hope, shock conservatives into rethinking this. It isn't always just a matter of reprising the successes that Senator McCarthy had, the 50 agents and communists and Fifth Amendment cases were so prominently featured by Stanton Evans, or the 100, it wasn't so much the achievements that we can discuss to change their minds. I think that it's very shocking to learn, which is something I've just written about, that the campaign against McCarthy originated and was promoted by the Communist Party USA, by the Daily Worker, and indeed by Stalin himself, that this, the genesis of the drive to shut McCarthy and the other investigators on Capitol Hill down comes from our mortal enemy in the Kremlin, Stalin, and his armies and in supported forces in the United States through the Daily Worker, through the Communist Party USA organization. And this was a concerted effort, and it's discussed. It's in my latest piece, which is at my website and also ran in the Epic Times. I lay out the quotations from a number of communist spokesmen, officers of the party, and indeed from Stalin himself, that were weaponized on purpose to spread out from the communist organs through the respectable press, through the liberal press, into the conservative side, the liberal side. And this has been one of the most successful disinformation operations that I think the Kremlin ever mounted. And every time a conservative castigates someone for McCarthyism, they are essentially doing Stalin's bidding. And I think that's a very shocking thought, and I hope that it causes some to rethink things.
Dinah West, these admonitions and the clarity with which you convey them is so appreciated, as is our time with you each week. I especially appreciate this long-form version of those conversations, and we'll look forward to having you back next week. Again, thank you for the great work you do these days at dinahwest.net and The Daily Caller and elsewhere, as well as these two really extraordinary books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Thank you, my dear. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.